Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the January episode of AZMCast. We're celebrating a new year with some new intro music, courtesy of our own DJMD, Dr. Zac Efron. January means the in-training exam episode, full of the fundamentals that make our job so great. Stuff so basic, so textbook, so mind-numbingly boring, that it might actually just save someone's life. But at the very least, it'll save you a couple points on your exam. This month, we're discussing GI bleeds, and you can't talk about GI bleeds without a great deal of poop jokes. Well, at least we can't. So while there is some good actual medicine mixed in with stool, Allie, Brian, and I hope that the benefits outweigh the risks of listening to this episode. You have been warned. Hide your kids. Hide your wife. Our apologies also to those of you who are not residents, but this one goes out to the faithful indentured servants who make our job so great. Study hard out there with a little extra help from this month's AZMCast on GI Bleed. Hi, everybody. Welcome to January. It's in-training exam prep time. All of you emergency doctors that are out there, your residents, you're going to be prepping for your in-training exam. And we brought some help to try to get you prepped for some of the stuff. We do this every year, and this year we're going to be talking about GI stuff, specifically GI bleeds, something that the in-training exam loves to ask about. We're going to cover a couple things, kind of go off on weird tangents, and hopefully give you something that's worthwhile for your test. So we have Brian Drummond.
Hello.
And Allie Min.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening.
Whatever time you happen to be listening to this. Good 3 a.m. before the in-training exam to you all for listening to this and cramming in everything you can. It would help if you actually put on headphones and then sandwiched yourself between a Rosens and a Tintin Alley to try to get as much knowledge in as possible right before the exam. So we're going to be talking about upper GI bleeds. The first thing I'll say before we start is the in-training exam is a good measure of how you are going to do on your board exam. Allie cannot talk about the oral board exam, but she'll just blather on about the written board exams all the time, so we have to mute her sometimes.
Yes, that's right. I like to blather.
So your in-training exam, it's a good idea of how you're going to be doing on future exams, namely your board exam. So try to study for it. Do your best. But also look at it, especially if you're a first and second year, as these are the gaps I need to fill in my knowledge. Don't stress about it. Don't go, oh, no, I'm going to kill somebody because I didn't know about acute intermittent porphyria. That may be true. But don't worry about it because you can just learn about it.
I just add, I think, you know, it's like every standardized test where the questions aren't really what you think they're going to be like. And so it's also good practice just understanding how these questions are written and what they're looking for, because it really is very similar to what written boards are going to look like. And
your recertification exam. Yeah. Yeah. This is awesome.
And there's a couple different styles of questions. There'll be the case-based ones where sometimes you see this huge paragraph of text. And one of the things that will help you with your test-taking skills is go right down to what the question is. Because there may be all of this text, and then the question has nothing to do with anything that's in the text. They just want you to recognize, hey, this is a patient with an upper GI bleed. Which of these medications is indicated for an upper GI bleed? Oh, okay. Well, I didn't need to read all the text to figure out the answer to this question. It's a bit of a time waster. And then there's always the if this, then that question, where they want you to assume the diagnosis based on, or make a diagnosis based on what they give you, and then the question will be about management.
management. The question will be about complications from your management or something else. So they'll want you to figure out what it is, and then they'll ask you a next step question. So do some practice questions, get a bead on some of the stuff you might be missing, and we're going to get into upper GI bleeds. So a guy walks into an ER, right? And the nurse says, "How can I help you?" And he says, and blood comes shooting out of his oropharynx. And that's often what's presented to us. So the patient comes in and has an upper GI bleed. Brian, what are the questions that you're going to ask this patient?
Hopefully he's done vomiting so I can ask him questions.
He may not answer.
I think the first thing is, you know, to me is mild or severe. To me, there's two GI bleeds. There's one like, yeah, I had some vomiting, I have normal vital signs, and then there's sick GI bleeds. And there's sometimes patients in between, but for your board tests, they're really going to show you sick GI bleeds. They're not going to like, oh, I had one episode of coffee ground emesis 3 days ago, and I come in with normal vital signs, and they're going to say, what do you do next? That's probably not the question they're going to ask. It'll probably be maybe a couple episodes of coffee ground emesis or bright red blood coming out of the mouth, maybe a melanotic stool. Those are questions you want to ask the patient. And so with that, now you're going to start to say, well, what's the cause? And when we talk about upper GI bleed, we think of, you know, the stomach, the esophagus, and the duodenum are kind of our main areas that we're looking for. The esophagus, things that we think about, you know, the worst case esophageal would be a perforation of the esophagus. That's right, Borov's tear. And sometimes you can see on a chest X-ray, I think it doesn't go to the left side,
yeah,
I think, more commonly.
Common.
You'll see either air or fluid and with severe vomiting. So that's something you can think of. The mildest esophageal tear would be like a Mallory Weiss tear, maybe a little bit of bright red blood, more specules in the vomit, or it just stopped afterwards.
This is one, the Borov's tear is one that I think the ITE loves because it's not super common, but if you miss it, it's a big deal. So the difference between the Mallory Weiss and the Borov's tear, Mallory Weiss is just kind of erosion or irritation or an injury through the intima, just that first layer, and a Borov's is all three layers all the way through to where you'll get air in the mediastinum, fluid in the mediastinum, infection, inflammation, and you'll see this may be one of those ones where they say a patient comes in and has this X-ray, what's your next step in management? And you have to look at the X-ray and realize that it's a widened mediastinum with air in it as opposed to a widened mediastinum with blood in it like an aortic dissection. Hopefully they'll give you more history to go along with that. But if you've never seen a chest X-ray with a Borov's tear, it would probably behoove you to go and Google that and go, oh, okay, that's what that looks like. In front of you, the patient will look like they are trying to die. Usually it's a lot of vomiting or maybe some kind of perforation from another reason. They may give you somebody that just had an endoscopy. Probably not, though. That's not technically the Borov's tear, but it is a perforation, and it's still through all three layers of the esophagus.
Or a history of violent vomiting recently, and the patient looks septic and toxic in front of you, and that would be another person to think about.
They'll also usually throw alcoholics in this. That's another key word. So you'll see the chest X-ray, alcoholic, vomiting. You think Borov's. Those are kind of your fusion thoughts.
And the Mallory Weiss tear, the purpose of the in-training exam of the boards is to make sure that as an emergency doctor, you can recognize and manage the sick stuff. They're not going to grill you on how to manage a Mallory Weiss tear because you treat it with reassurance. This is going to be your patient after, you know, an episode of vomiting, maybe two or three, that says, I had a small streak of blood in my vomit. And that's going to be a, I'm very sorry that you were throwing up. Here's some ondansetron. Have a nice day. On the other hand, other things that can make you bleed in your esophagus, there's certainly esophagitis, inflammation. Probably the biggest one they'll ask you about will be patients that have HIV or AIDS and have candidal esophagitis. So be wary of kind of where your levels are for HIV and the AIDS-defining illnesses that kind of go in through that. And then last one for the esophagus is going to be varices. So look for your liver stigmata. Look for your patient that comes in and has the obvious ascites. Maybe they're jaundiced, and certainly has a history of it as well, because that's going to aid you in your management of which direction you're going to go in trying to treat these patients and stopping their upper GI bleed.
Yeah, I think varices is a big one to focus on, and we're going to talk about management later, but they really like to ask about, you know, because that's one of the major emergencies, right, with GI bleeds, and so that's something to really spend some time looking at.
Okay. Moving our way down through the esophagus and things that can cause you to bleed out your mouth, going into the stomach, you can have gastritis or gastric ulcers. And this is going to be certainly a different history. This is going to be somebody who has pain with eating. So when you eat and you kind of secrete some acid, it's painful on your ulcer and it can cause it to bleed. The more concerning one is actually a perforated ulcer, whether it's gastric or duodenal, and you're going to differentiate between these two. Well, if they're perforated, you're not going to differentiate. You're going to have peritonitis and a rigid abdomen, and you call a surgeon. It's time to go. But otherwise, the peptic ulcer disease, the duodenal ulcer, is going to be pain that gets better after you eat, because you secrete your bicarb and it's going to kind of cool off some stuff, versus pain that's going to be worse with eating, that's going to cause acid secretion and kind of splash more acid on your ulcer. I don't know that as an emergency doctor that makes a huge difference to me of whether it's gastric or duodenal. It's an ulcer. We're going to treat it like an ulcer.
Mm-hmm. And here we're in the setting of GI bleed, and these will either present with coffee ground emesis, usually, rarely, you know, if you hear bright red blood, you're thinking this is a severe bleed, that they're actively bleeding very fast, and then melena would be the other way that they would present with this. Some of the historical factors you could have would be H. pylori exposure, so maybe they've had H. pylori in the past, or treatment, where they've, I've been treated for H. pylori in the past, but that was 5 years ago, maybe they got reinfected. NSAID use or chronic steroid use would be things that would put you at a higher risk for having bleed or erosion in your stomach. So those may be something that, I've been on ibuprofen for my knee pain for the last 2 years, and I've been taking, you know, 1,000 milligrams a day, or 5 times a day, and just been pounding it. So those are some other historical things they may throw up that put you in that ulcer range.
And then there's a handful of things that will cause you to expel blood from your mouth that have nothing to do with your stomach. I think we often think these are upper GI bleeds, but you have to distinguish that between epistaxis, where you're bleeding so badly as a posterior bleed that's going down the back of your throat, you're swallowing it, that you're digesting this blood, and then you vomit up coffee ground emesis. And I find this happens a lot with kids, where the first presentation is not necessarily the nosebleed, but the kid's been swallowing blood, doesn't talk about it, they have a dry nose in the winter time, and they're swallowing all this blood, and then they vomit, and it looks like coffee grounds, it looks like blood. The parents are concerned about that. You look in the nose, and it's all friable and kind of scabbed over. Usually they're nose pickers too. Another thing could be an oropharyngeal bleed. Maybe they're bleeding from tonsillectomy. That's one thing that I've seen a couple times. It's been super scary. Post-tonsillectomy bleed. Or somewhere else in the oropharynx where they're swallowing blood. And then the last one's going to be a pulmonary bleed. It's not vomiting blood. It's coughing up blood. And I think the difference that I can figure with those two is whether or not, first of all, the patient's vomiting or coughing in the ED. And then, is it bright red blood in scant amounts, or is it bright red blood in large amounts, or coffee ground emesis? The scant amounts, where they cough up quite a bit of blood and they're in respiratory distress, that's more pulmonary, versus the large amount of bright red blood and coffee ground, that's going to be more GI.
Yeah, I think for the boards, though, they will, in the IT exam, they should be more explicit in the question stem. This stuff becomes confusing clinically when the patient's in front of you, but for exam purposes, they should be pretty explicit on where the source of bleeding is.
Yeah, they won't give you the question stem that says a patient comes into the ER and says, bleh, because I don't know how you spell bleh. Is it with E's or A's?
It's a B.
It's a B. I think both.
B. It's a B.
Start with
bleh.
B.
Yeah.
B-L.
I feel like there's a vowel blend.
A diphthong of some kind?
I don't know what that means.
I don't know, but I don't get to use that word often.
Sounds very Vietnamese.
Recorded.
Like a food.
Either that or delicious. I wore it on my foot.
It was a creamy diphthong.
Yeah.
With a, All right, let me ask you, so because we need to do something clinical with this, how do you ask a patient to determine how much they actually vomited up? Because I feel like patients, when they vomit up blood, how much did you vomit up? It was a lot. How do you get people to quantify how much they actually threw up and make a decision based on that history?
It turned the whole toilet red.
I ask them if their vomit was, you know, vomit with streaks of blood, was it a cup of blood, or was it gallons of blood coming out? And I kind of give them those three options and let them identify as close as they can. And then that gives me kind of a gist of what it is. I don't care as much about how often they vomited or how much came out as opposed to how much blood they think came out. I think that when we get to the lower J bleed, that's a harder question to address. But at least for the upper, most people are given those three options, they can kind of associate with it. So that's what I use.
And I'm also curious in something that has no clinical relevance. When someone comes in and they say that they've threw up 12 times, do you count each episode of even if it's 12 times in a row as one episode of vomiting, and then they get better and then they go back for another episode after 30 minutes? Or is each is that one continuous vomit?
I think it's one continuous vomit.
I just don't care.
Yeah, I don't care. Yeah. How often do they clean their toilet bowl? That's probably the better question.
How many flushes did it take?
I hate to be that guy of like, I don't really care how many times you threw up, but sometimes they say those numbers. I was like, well, maybe that means something if you like took a break and then vomited and then took another break and then vomited. Yeah, that's probably pretty bad versus like, oh, like you got it up, you got it out of your system 12 times.
And now you're better.
Yeah, good. Now you're better.
That's like the fever question. You know, they have a fever. Like, my kid had a fever. Got it.
Great.
But they still have a fever. No, it's, yep, got it. It's one thing.
I have a prediction. Your child's going to have a fever when they go home, too. So ask them about pain. Painless hematemesis probably bothers me a lot more. It makes me think of more of a vascular bleed of some kind versus painful hematemesis that makes you think maybe it's an ulcer or something else. Ask about meds, if they're on a bunch of NSAIDs, if they're on blood thinners, because you may need to reverse them depending on the reason why, and if they've got any reason to have a coagulopathy. Physical exam, look for signs of shock. You should be able to recognize those. If you haven't, then you need to go back and do some more clinical rotations and kind of see some sicker patients. But treat the shock. Look for signs of anemia. I think in a nice clinical pearl that I picked up from Kevin Riley, look at your palm versus the patient's palm. Look under their eyelids at their sclera, because most everybody has the same skin tone in those areas. And then look at the mucous membranes as well. And that's been pretty helpful for me to pick this kind of stuff up. I've found a lot of patients, when the parents come in and say that they are yellow actually means anemic and pale. Look for some of the stigmata of liver dysfunction and, you know, see if you can figure out a source from that. And then the dreaded DRE. Do you need a rectal exam on a patient that has an upper GI bleed?
Absolutely not.
This will not be one of your test questions. True or false, you need to do a DRE
for
upper GI bleed. That will not be on your ITE or your boards, but it's an interesting clinical question.
Yeah, I don't think you... Go ahead.
Again, not for ITE necessarily, but in the patient who you're concerned has ulcers but doesn't have a peritoneal exam, do you do a rectal exam to see if you think the ulcer is bleeding? Does that matter?
No, I don't. So I have my own opinions on this. I think I've expressed through some hemocult testing nonsense in this department. But my take is, when someone comes in with concerns of a GI bleed, I want to know, like Aaron said, are they in shock? Yes or no? So it's a vital sign. It's a hemoglobin. And have they pooped blood, or are they pooping brown? And if they're pooping brown and they're not pooping black and they're not pooping blood, I don't need to do a rectal exam. If they're telling me they're pooping black, okay, you're pooping black. I agree. Yes, it could be the beets they ate or the iron pills or something.
Pepto.
But to me, fine.
I have pictures on my phone. Hold on, I'll show you.
But
oh,
even
gosh, that is the worst thing that's ever happened to cell phones. It's like, oh, doctor, I have pictures of my vomit and my diarrhea. No, wait, that's the vomit. No, I think that's the diarrhea. I can't remember.
I have a baggie in my purse, too. Oh,
would you like to unwrap it? No, I don't want to. But to me,
it smells like Shigella.
If you ever get into the problem and the patient's like, well, I haven't looked at my poop in 10 years, okay, do a rectal exam. But to me, if you're doing a rectal exam, you're just looking at the poop yourself. I don't believe in hemocults. I think that's a colon cancer screen. And if you do one, you should do two more and screen them for colon cancer. And you should do it in three different bowel movements. But no one does it the right way. You can do a rectal exam and cause blood to come on your finger. And so why are we doing this? It's irrelevant. You want to know if the patient's sick or not sick. If they're not sick, most of these actually go home now. It used to be you admitted every GI bleed. I remember it was like everyone goes to the ICU and you're just sitting there like, they look really good. Their hemoglobin's 15 times 3, you know? This is not too bad. But we would just admit everyone. Now we're sending a lot of these home and realizing an outpatient scope or follow-up, maybe lifestyle modifications, if you think you know what the cause is a realistic. But if they're sick, you don't need it. To me, you're going to treat them either way, regardless of the result. So why would you torture a patient who's vomiting and give them another stimulus that they don't need?
I think that if a patient tells you they haven't looked at their poop in 10 years, you absolutely need a hemocult because they are automatically a liar, okay? you need a hemocult and a Utox and
visual acuity,
a lot of other testing because I think they are lying to you. All right, so
I don't believe people that say they don't look at their poop. I mean, how does that happen?
Everyone looks at their poop.
I don't get it.
Do they?
You have to.
Too much information, but I don't understand how.
How do you know when you're done wiping?
Right, that's what I'm
exactly.
saying.
Exactly.
Transitively, you can take a lot away from the knowledge of all three of us from this portion of the conversation. I would not make that extra mental leap, though. Okay. So management. So a patient comes in. The first thing that I was always told: two large bore IVs. I remember when I was an intern, we had a upper GI bleed, and the nurse came up to me and said, "Hey, doc, I put in that second large bore IV just like you asked in front of my attending." And I said, "I didn't ask you for a second large bore IV." He goes, "Dude, I'm trying to help you out here, all right?" "Oh, yeah, thanks, Orlando. Appreciate that, man. Thanks for helping me out." So you want two large bore IVs because if they start to crump, you want a short, fat line that you can cram a ton of blood in right away. I think that there, if the patient says, you know, "I threw up once after a night of heavy drinking, there was some blood in it," well, you don't necessarily need to put 14s in their EJs, but you should at least make sure you get some access on somebody that's got an upper GI bleed. IVO2 monitor, airway breathing, circulation, advanced airway equipment at the bedside. And if they keep throwing up, you need to secure the airway. All right, also not on your in-training exam, but how many episodes of hematemesis does it take for you to stick a tube in their glottis?
I would say a lot. In my life, I think I could count on one hand how many I've had to intubate for a massive GI bleed. A lot of people will vomit once, and then they'll have a period of an hour or two where they don't vomit blood again. And I don't tube all. I mean, it's the person who's vomiting every 5 minutes, blood is coming up, and their pressure's dropping, and you're seeing how much they're filling a basin of blood. And you're like, "Wow, that was all your body's blood. You're pretty sick."
Just auto-transfuse. Use it right back.
Right. Just swallow it, right? Just swallow the blood.
Get some chicken wings in there. And
oh, God.
Buffalo ranch sauce, you know.
Type O positive spicy.
But those are the ones I think that I would be tubing is because they're so sick from that hematemesis that they're probably going to go to the OR. Now, that's set aside from those that I intubate maybe to do a scope for a sedation in the ER. I don't count those as truly intubating for the GI bleed, but that's my experience.
I was going to say, I don't know that the number of episodes determines whether or not you need an airway. I think it's sort of the whole clinical picture. in general, as we said. If they're unstable, if they're altered and they're not protecting their airway, I think there's other factors that come into play, not just how many times you've thrown up.
So I'm going to give a very, it's got a little bit of reasoning behind it, but it's an in my experience thing. I'm going to say three. If you vomit three times, hematemesis and ED, probably going to get an airway. And there's a couple of reasons why I say that. The first reason is because I think if you vomit once, you've got some hematemesis, you've got an upper GI bleed. You're probably not going to have another one, as Brian said. You vomit the second time in the ED, and I say to myself, you know what? You probably aren't going to go to the floor. You're going to scare the daylights out of the poor doctors and nurses on the floor. You probably are going to end up going to the ICU. And by the time I've made that decision, if they vomited a third time, they generally, as Brian said, don't do that. And so by the time you're getting to the third episode of hematemesis that they've been in the ED, hopefully, you know, 4-6 hours, if we're not boarding for 24 hours, that's a lot of hematemesis. And I'm worried about this patient. And I'm going to start talking to the ICU about, hey, this person's vomiting a lot. They're going to need a scope. They need a scope sooner rather than later. I think we should think about intubating this patient. So it has a little bit of rationale behind it. It's certainly not evidence-based. It's very experience-based, but it's an approach. So suggested approach, but it's not, oh, you threw up three times, you know, we're going to intubate you.
Well, I think this,
think about progression of every time they do something, you need to make a decision.
And I think Aaron's talking about gross hematemesis, too. We're not talking about coffee ground emesis three times. I think that's fair,
correct,
right? This is bright red. You're filling something, not specks of blood, filling something. Those are the people we're talking about. Just so like, well, they had three little specks of blood. No. That's Aaron's talking about sick patients that you're like, this is concerning. I think that's a reasonable approach.
And of course, if they're altered and they're vomiting, they can't protect their airway, it's time to go. If they are in shock, they really need blood. You know they're losing blood. They need blood. You can give them some crystalloid while you're waiting for blood, but they need blood. And I think it seems less and less our residents are afraid to give blood. I think there was a period of time where our residents were really nervous to give blood to people. I think that we're a lot more comfortable giving blood to patients that need blood. And I think that comes from kind of the trauma literature of saying, you know, with damage control resuscitation and saying if you replace too much with crystalloid, you end up with a coagulopathy. Most of these patients already have a coagulopathy, so they need some blood back, and they probably need all three products if they're bleeding a ton.
And this is emergency release, not waiting for a type cross-matched.
Yeah, if they are in shock, blood. They need blood now. Mm-hmm. Go grab the blood that's over in your, that's quickest to get, and start infusing that. And remember, you can give O negative to women, but you can give O positive to men because they're not going to develop an Rh antibody against their baby. So next, for the patient maybe that's not horribly in shock, you're not having to manage all this, the admitting team's going to want to know that you did something to try to slow down their bleeds. So usually that's going to be a PPI plus or minus octreotide. I think in the patient that has a pure ulcer, octreotide certainly not going to help. But in a patient that has varices, they probably have some gastric bleeding as well. So we tend to either do PPI or we do PPI plus octreotide in order to decrease the amount of acid production and try to shrink down those varices a bit more. And then ceftriaxone for upper GI bleeds?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think there's good literature started to come out that it used to be maybe 10, 15 years ago. I don't think people routinely gave it, but I think now we're starting to see that there is associated bacterial crossing of the blood-brain barrier, blood-stomach barrier that at that time... The haggis blood starts going across. But I think ceftriaxone's reasonable. I think the ideal medicine, if I remember, would be like erythromycin, partly is because that would actually clear out the GI tract and allows for best scoping, but we don't have IV erythromycin around all the time. So ceftriaxone's very reasonable to give.
And then something, we may not be as hesitant to give blood, but we seem very hesitant to do NG tubes. We don't like doing NG tubes on patients. We'll do lots of painful painful procedures, but somebody suggests an NG tube, we're like, you sadistic monster, what is wrong with you? I think that in a patient, this again goes back to my patient who has multiple episodes of GI bleed. You have one, I don't think you need to be tortured with an NG tube. When you have that second episode in the ED, you're going to get an NG tube to clear this stuff out. But sometimes you put in that NG tube and it all starts to come out and you're like, whoa, hold on a sec. I think I'm going to exsanguinate you by putting this thing to suction. What does it take for you to put an NG tube in a patient?
I think it would be after my endotracheal tube.
After?
it's hard. I mean, I remember when I trained, you had to put an NG tube in every GI patient. Then you had to irrigate them out to ensure that the bleeding had stopped. And I thought this was crazy at the time, and it seemed crazy. I mean, you're just, all these people are getting tortured for maybe one melanotic stool or one coffee ground emesis, and we really backed off from that. And I think that was the right thing to do. I think it was way overused, and now is probably underused at times, but you know, the purpose is, what are you trying to see with your NG tube? That's what I think. Do you want to see if there's continued blood loss down in the stomach? Is that something you're trying to do? Are you putting it down
to... Is it diagnostic?
Right. Is it diagnostic? Am I trying to do that? Am I trying to decrease the blood in there that's then causing them to vomit from distension or irritation? That's another reason to do it. Or... you're just wanting to play games with their nose and
hurt them. Or trying to protect their airway because they're vomiting right. So much that, well, let's just suck this out your nose so that it, you know,
won't
bypasses.
So I think it just depends on what you're doing. I don't think it's mandatory for most GI bleed cases, upper GI bleed cases.
When I was training, they always said you could worsen bleeding or disturb varices with an NG tube, and that was always the big fear. But I can't think of very many times when I've done an NG tube alone without intubating an upper GI bleed in the management, unless, you know, one of the admitting services has really been adamant about doing that, but I don't think that it's played much of a role in our management.
I've always loved the notion of, like, don't stick this red rubber flexible NG tube down the patient's esophagus. You're going to cause bleeding. Make room for my rigid metal scope that I'm going to put down instead. Right. It's like, all right, wait a minute.
Well, I think that's also lore, too, about the NG tubes, that they made the esophageal varices worse.
Right.
So if you hear that is medical lore. That does not hurt the, you know, it's not like they're popping off the varices. So if you hear that,
they're already bleeding. You're seeing them anyway.
Right. It won't change it.
All right. And then there's always the debate of when you call GI for an upper GI bleed, is the patient going to be too sick to scope or not sick enough to scope? Patients that are continuing to vomit up blood or have maybe the NG tube and they're continuing to put out blood, they really need a scope, and you need to get GI involved early because they can go down and they can band or they can cauterize. If you've got a patient that has a Boerhaave's tear, that is very different, and that patient needs CT surgery to actually go in and patch the hole and maybe do an irrigation washout. But it's always the question, is the patient going to be too sick to scope or not sick enough? If they're not sick enough to scope, they're going to go to the floor. If they're too sick to scope, they're going to go to the ICU, and at some point they're going to get their scope. But GI needs to be involved in these early, and I think the information that GI needs to know is clinical appearance of the patient, what's their hemoglobin, and how much blood have they put out, if you're kind of tracking that, how many times have they thrown up in the ED. And then when you're drawing your labs, along with the second large bore IV, make sure you get that type and screen. I think that's the thing I see missed most often with upper GI bleeds. You can do a type and screen pretty easily, but if you don't draw it with that first blood draw, then you have to go back and do a fresh draw. And that can often be time consuming for the nurse. It can be a little bit of a pain, and it delays the blood that this patient may end up needing. Blakemore or Minnesota, have you had to put in either, both, neither?
I have not. I've seen them.
You've not had to put one in?
I've, knock on wood.
Really?
I've not had to.
Yeah, I have not either. We've had it to the bedside. I've had patients that eventually had it put in that I started treating, but at the time, they didn't need it.
I did not expect to be the only one who's done it. That's great. All right, so in all of my expertise with my one Blakemore that I put in, so The idea is if you have a patient with bad varices, that you can tamponade the varices by putting this huge balloon that is distensible with pressure into a huge tube that is distensible. They're not great. They're probably the last thing you do before the patient codes. But you're going to obviously intubate the patient first and get them with adequate sedation, because what you're going to do next is put this long rubber balloon down that will inflate both with a gastric port and then with an esophageal port, and you just cram a ton of air in there, and it will balloon up so that it will suction out from the stomach any blood that's still there, and you keep going with the distension of the balloon until you kind of stop the bleeding, or in my case, until the balloon pops, which happens sometimes with these as well. This is a whole podcast on itself that should be video and not audio, but know that this is one of your last-ditch attempts in a patient that is hemorrhaging so significantly that you're worried that they're going to code on you. You can take them to the operating room, but that's generally not going to help with varices. It's only going to help if you've got an actual rupture or a tear, so really you have to do your best to tamponade the bleeding. GI can try to go down in scope, but sometimes they can't see. And so if you can tamponade this and correct coagulopathy, maybe you can spare them enough time to where GI can then go in and scope if the bleeding slows down.
The time that I've thought about these is for transferring patients. So I see it as someone, you don't have GI or a general surgeon on board that can do a scope and or surgery to stop the bleeding. You're looking to transfer the patient because they need to go to those, you know, those are kind of my two therapies, right? I need someone to scope them, and that can be a general surgeon or GI normally. And then worst case, it would be a surgeon to open up their belly and start ligating vessels. And, you know, that would be the end result of the severest upper GI bleeds. So I think that's another time that you would think about it. But these are super sick patients. The hard part is if you have someone coming in to do the scope, why would you put a tube down that they're then going to have to pull to that? To me, that delays
your clot.
Right. And so I would let them scope. And then if they said, oh, we can't do this, okay, maybe you put it in waiting for the surgeon to get in OR room. That would, like Aaron said, it's kind of buying you time and trying to cause some pressure.
Right. And the severest of these upper GI bleeds, as Brian said, usually are also lower GI bleeds. If you've got a really brisk upper GI bleed that doesn't have time to get digested, then it will work its way through and you have bright red blood coming out the bottom. So that brings us to the other end of your GI tract where you have lower GI bleed. I find this to be a lot more common as a complaint than upper GI bleeds. And I find it to generally be a lot less worrisome, but when it's bad, it's real bad. And I've had a lot more bad lower GI bleeds than I've had bad upper GI bleeds. Would you agree?
I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Differential for this. Most common thing you're going to have is diverticulosis. It's going to be a thin-walled vessel, or a thin-walled intestine that just kind of has some bleeding associated with it, some irritation, some inflammation, and they've got a little bit of blood that comes out. Diverticulosis used to be something that we would say, don't eat seeds, nuts, anything like that anymore. That's actually been debunked, and it was one of the first times where I realized that I need to keep up with medical literature, that what I learned in medical school is no longer correct when I started telling patients that. And the other doc that was with me, he's like, that's not true. We don't do that anymore. It's like, oh no, I'm behind. But diverticulosis is going to be the most common thing. And really what you need, if you've got this lower GI bleed from diverticulosis, you don't need a CT scan to find it. You need a colonoscopy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is not something that needs to be diagnosed in the ED because we're not going to do anything about it. And I think it's often a little unnerving for patients to come in and they've got blood in their stool and they're expecting a lot of stuff, and you go, no, we just want to make sure it's not excessive, and then you need to go see somebody else. You know? Probably the second most common one I see is hemorrhoids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the adage is that the internal hemorrhoids bleed but don't hurt, and the external hemorrhoids hurt but don't bleed. And I've, of course, found that never to be true. It's usually a mix therein, or you have both.
Right.
If you're that fortunate to have bleeding hemorrhoids and to have external hemorrhoids. If you've got a really brisk upper GI bleed, then that's going to come out, and that's not going to be subtle. I mean, the times that I've seen that where you kind of roll the patient over and there's blood in the stool, you're rolling them over because they're intubated and they're crashing, and you know, and you go, oh, well, there's our source, you know. So you do need to look in these patients, but it's usually not subtle. Trauma can always do it. Anal fissures, we always take a good look. You can have aneurysms that do it. Tumors, inflammatory bowel disease, and then all the peds things, like mom will come in and say that there's blood in the diaper. The biggest thing you want to be concerned about would be Meckel's diverticulum, which is a painless rectal bleeding, and it's large volume. So you've got ectopic gastric tissue that causes bleeding, and it's a lot of blood, and it's painless is always tough because it's in a diaper. These kids can't really tell you if they're having pain, but it's all blood. It's not blood mixed with stool or anything else.
I think in the differential that Garen said, you know, tumors also can go upper and lower GI. We talk about things that can go both. Tumors, just think about esophageal, gastric tumors. I think gastric tumors is one of the common causes of GI bleed in some of the Asian countries. I think Japan, that's one of their common causes of bleeding. Mm-hmm. Other things to think about are be vasculitis as well along the esophagus. Anywhere can cause that. And then the other thing in the lower GI tract, think about is mesenteric ischemia would be a big one, especially in older patients.
And that is going to be pain out of proportion to exam. Dysentery, which is just fun to say, you know. I hesitate to tell somebody they have dysentery because they're afraid they're going to die along the Oregon Trail, but it's usually Salmonella, Shigella, invasive E. coli, Campylobacter, some of these bacterial infections that will cause a bloody diarrhea. These are important to figure out. These will definitely be on your in-training exam, and they have a couple corollaries that will kind of rapid fire off. So Campylobacter can often be associated with Guillain-Barré. So you get Campylobacter, and a few weeks later you come in and you can't walk right, then you can't sit up straight, and then you can't breathe. E. coli.
Doesn't Campylobacter also mimics appendicitis?
It sure
I think
can.
That is another like buzzword that they'll have on that with right lower quadrant pain.
E. coli, especially if it's the Shiga toxin producing E. coli, is associated with hemolytic uremic syndrome. They're not going to ask you if it's the 0157H7. But it is, okay? They won't give you, if they give you that question, ITE, is it 0156H7? 0157H7? P157H7? It's like, you sat down in the wrong room. You're
right.
Taking a totally different test. There are cameras watching you just to mess with you. There's Shigella, which is associated in small children with seizures, okay? Mm-hmm. And then Salmonella is in young children, especially less than age 3 months, you can get Salmonella meningitis as well. So bloody diarrhea in very young kids, you have to be concerned about bacteremia and meningitis as well.
I think for inflammatory bowel disease, the other thing to read up on are the extra intestinal manifestations. Exams really like to ask about those things. So Crohn's, what does it look like outside of the GI tract? And same with ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm. And these are also diagnoses that we're not going to be able to figure out in the ED. They need a colonoscopy to tell you that's what it is. But that's painful, bloody diarrhea often. You can get a CT scan that shows some inflammation, but that's not the diagnosis. You can get a CRP and a SED rate that shows inflammation, but that's not the diagnosis. So people that come in with these IBD flares or maybe a first-time diagnosis, we're not trying to find this diagnosis. We're trying to make sure there's nothing dangerous. We want to make sure that you haven't perforated. We want to make sure you don't have toxic megacolon from ulcerative colitis. And if you don't have those things, you need to see a GI to kind of do your workup. I mean, we want to try to help these people, but steroids and mesalamine and everything else is that it's something the GI doctor needs to figure out after you get biopsies and stuff. Don't alter what the pathologist is going to have to sort through by giving an atom bomb of steroids.
And these, like IBD and dysentery, will be a bloody mucousy stool. So that's how they'll kind of describe it in their test questions. That may start to cue you in on those processes as opposed to a diverticulosis, a tumor, you know, an AVM, something like that.
So I found there's probably four types of descriptions of the blood. Someone comes in and I had blood on my stool, and one of them is just pure blood. And if it's just pure blood, you had a bowel movement full of blood, that's very concerning. And that's somebody that needs probably to have the scope there, because they're probably going to be hypotensive. They're probably going to have a low H&H. They're going to need to be admitted. And then blood mixed with stool might be dysentery, might be IBD. Maroon stools, that's just kind of blood that's been mixing in there for a while, might be more diverticulosis. Melena is probably going to be somebody that's had an upper GI bleed that's just kind of on its way down. So again, how do you measure the amount of blood that somebody has passed in their lower GI bleed?
Oh, this is the whole toilet bowl is red.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, like Brian said, it's a tough thing for people to quantify. Mm. It's very anxiety and fear provoking when you see blood coming out of your bottom. Mm-hmm. But I think we ask probably similar questions. You know, was it just on the paper when you wiped and the stool itself was a normal color? Was it streaks on the stool or mixed in? Mm-hmm. Or was it just all blood? And I think more than necessarily giving them like the cooking measurements that you might do with upper GI bleeds, I think that means less when you're talking about a lower GI bleed, and really you're just trying to get these big categories.
Yeah,
I don't ask the toilet bowl question because, like, you know, as we all know, a couple drops can make the whole toilet bowl red. So I like the, when you wiped, was there brown poop and blood, or was it just all blood on that? And you, like, you didn't even see poop, you know? So that's kind of a question I ask. Like, was there any real poop in there, or was it all blood when you're wiping? And, you know, that you're like, oh, okay, that's real.
The amazing questions we get to ask strangers, right?
Yeah.
And then we want to ask about pain. You want to ask about medications, coagulopathy, just the same. And very similar to your upper GI bleed, you want signs of shock, signs of anemia. Look for liver dysfunction. Try to find your source. And then rectal exam this time, you kind of need to do.
I think at least an external exam, and it depends on what you're doing. You're not doing, you know, if they're saying it, I pooped and a bunch of blood came out, I still agree that they had blood. I'm not worried about the hemocult. I want to look at the rectum and really look, you know, right? Is there hemorrhoids? Is there anal fissures? Because to me, that's a quick diagnosis, that if you have a good story and it looks like an anal fissure and it is an anal fissure when you look at it, you're done. You know, and then the follow-on from a rectal to me would be anoscopy, the same thing. Like, I offer it sometimes. You're not gaining a whole lot, but maybe you're seeing the internal, you know, maybe you're seeing an internal hemorrhoid. Maybe you're just seeing an excoriated, like, rectum, you know, and that's something. You're like, oh, okay, you just have a real bad colitis or something going on here that's just inflamed down there versus it's totally clean. Okay, I think the blood's higher up in another source, so I need to start thinking about that.
So I'll disagree with Brian about the hemocult, because I do not believe patients when they tell me that they have blood in their stool.
You don't look in their diapers, Aaron?
I do look in the diapers, and I get the hemocult, because some of my favorite diagnoses for lower GI bleeding kids is flaming hot cheetosis, red vinitis, and gatoradorrhea. Okay, I can't tell you how many patients I've had that come in with bloody stool that have a negative hemocult.
I really like gatoradorrhea.
It is my favorite one. And it was because they had red Gatorade. And the diaper, I thought this was going to be a Meckel's diverticulum. The diaper is all blood. Mm-hmm. And then we guaiac the kid, and it's negative. I go, well, that's interesting.
Why is a kid in diapers getting Gatorade? Oh, I guess toddlers, if they're wearing. Okay, fine.
Maybe. I had an 18-month-old with red Kool-Aid they were drinking and having diarrhea, and it was coming out red because it was transiting so fast. And you're like, oh, that looks like Kool-Aid. It doesn't look like blood. And you're like, okay, what were you drinking? Red Kool-Aid.
And I didn't know red vines did that.
If you eat enough red food dye, you can you can put it through. So I definitely think that the guaiac has its place, unless you've got the other risk factors to say, is this legit or not? Do you actually have blood in your stool? Or is it now the beets, the iron, the other things that you're taking that are causing your bloody, quote-unquote, stool? Yeah. So,
I think another historical thing that is important to me for clinically in these patients is if there's a clearing. So to me, I'll ask, have you had another bowel movement, and how was that? If it's every bowel movement's blood coming out, that's to me totally different than someone who had a bloody bowel movement and then now they say, oh no, it was a normal form stool. You're like, oh, I think they're probably a lot more stable than someone who continues to bleed. So that's a follow-on question I'll ask.
And we didn't talk about current jelly stool, Aaron.
Yeah, so current jelly stool. I finally saw current jelly once, and I looked at it and was like, that's gross. I wouldn't eat that even if I didn't associate it with...
I've never seen it in real life, jelly or the stool.
I've seen the jelly. I've never seen the current jelly stool. So the current jelly stool is associated with intussusception. The other thing that they'll put along with that is the kid pulls their knees to their chest. They're generally between about 6 months and 5 years of age. They have colicky, crying fits, screaming, pulling knees to chest, and then that is punctuated at the end with a period of lethargy, almost difficult to arouse kind of status. And if they pass a current jelly stool, there's some dead bowel in that current jelly stool related to the intussusception. The treatment for that is to get them to interventional radiology to do an air contrast enema to both diagnose and treat the intussusception. But if they are sick and they're passing current jelly stool, they may actually need to go to surgery instead. All right, so management, lower GI bleed, the initial stuff, very similar to what we just talked about. ABCs, IV O2 monitor, two large bore IVs, make sure you get a type and screen and a hemoglobin with that. Treat shock with blood. And in this one, do you try to find the source? I think it, again, depends on how much blood you're putting out. If you've got blood on the toilet paper only, I don't care to find the source in the ED. I say, we can offer you to stick this clear funnel up your butt and take a look for hemorrhoids, and that's generally not agreed upon by patients. Instead they say, well, all right, I'll go see my GI doctor, a GI doctor, for a colonoscopy. And I warn them, if the GI doctor is not able to fit you in the next 9 years, you can always come back here if it gets worse or if you have another episode, but the colonoscopy is going to have to be done by a GI doctor. And unless it is melena, unless it is a bright red blood per rectum that's all blood, large bloody bowel movements, or you've got a low H&H or something else, they're not going to do it during your hospitalization.
And I think the other time you need to find the source is, as Brian said, if you're worried about mesenteric ischemia or their exam is really remarkable for, you know, significant abdominal pain, then you might be imaging anyway, and you're going to start looking for, you know, emergent OR intervention causes.
And so for those sick bleeds, how do you distinguish somebody that we're going to call GI for, somebody that we're going to call interventional radiology for, or somebody that we're going to call surgery for to do a hemicolectomy?
IR is never my first call, so I can take that off the list probably right away.
IR is usually something that GI or surgery do to try to placate you until they figure out what they're going to do.
I usually just order a tagged RBC perfusion study.
Yeah, and
that's very convenient. That's better than anything else.
Yeah, way more information.
That happened once when I was in residency, that GI and surgery were talking about getting that, and they're trying to get a tagged red blood cell scan. As we're pushing blood in the level one through the patient, we're like, wrong answer. A tagged red blood cell scan is never the right choice on your in training exam.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No.
A tagged red blood cell scan, even though it sounds super cool, of like, we're gonna attach a radioisotope to some red blood cells and track them and be like, hey, look, there's where you're bleeding out right there, you're dying because, hey, isn't that, oh, there they go. So
I think that will never be an answer. I think a PET scan for this exam will never be an answer. And I had one others that I just...
Autopsy?
Yeah, autopsy will not be an answer. Bad answers. If you check those, you're wrong. I think for these patients, if they're low hemoglobin and they look like they're in shock, I'm calling a surgeon. That would be my first choice, because the most definitive care for most of these would be XLAP and, like Aaron said, hemicolectomy. Take out whatever the bleeding source is. So to me, that would be my first call, and getting them involved immediately. If you have a stable hemoglobin, you can't say stable unless you did two, a normal hemoglobin and normal vital signs, it would be very weird for me to call a surgeon on that patient right then. And most of those you're probably going to send home. So determine, it's hard to find a true GI lower bleeder that I would call GI first, unless they maybe had just done a colonoscopy and you're thinking this is a perf or some kind of like tumor that they found, it was bleeding, and you want them to go in and inject the tumor. Mm-hmm. Like maybe those would be some times, but I agree. I don't think IR would be my first choice, though it comes up in the discussion. Mm-hmm. I would probably, if a sick bleeder, I would talk to surgery first.
Yeah, I think that there's not, if you think about what GI needs to do for an endoscopy, they just need a sedated patient. And what they need to do for a colonoscopy is they need to clean you out with Go Lightly, and they need to have you prepped, and they need to be able to look through everything that's in there and try to figure out where the bleed is. They can't do that with a scope, not emergently. So I don't think GI for a lower GI bleed is going to be an option, unless your cause for the lower GI bleed is an upper GI bleed.
Right.
And that'd the source is upper, and then they can go in and do an endoscopy. But I don't really think there's much indication for an emergent colonoscopy. Instead, you're probably going to have surgery come in and say, surgery, do you want to take this patient for an XLAP, or do you want IR to go in and squirt some gel foam for an embolization to try to embolize the area that's bleeding? And both of those can be valid, but I think the first call is for a surgeon.
Yeah, and I think hopefully you're starting to think about what your cause is of the GI bleed here, right? If maybe the person has inflammatory bowel disease and you think it's a flare, you know, you're going down that pathway. If, like Ali said, you would probably image, if you think this is a mesenteric ischemia or some kind of perforation, those are patients, or you think it's a tumor, those are patients that probably need a CT scan, and then that would help guide you. If you think this is just like, you know, a really bad hemorrhoid or an AVM that kind of went, you're probably just going to be admitting them for serial hemoglobins and making sure they're not decompensating if you're worried about them. But a lot of these patients still go home now. It's, right. You know, it's hard to find a super sick lower GI bleeder that, you know, is dropping their hemoglobin, has unstable vital signs, even if they've had some. This is more of a chronic process. A lot of these times, these diverticulosis are just like they bleed intermittently and it goes on for a while. They'll trend down their hemoglobin and eventually need transfusion to keep them up, and possibly surgical or GI intervention in the outpatient setting.
Yeah, I think the ones that need to be admitted are not subtle. It's like the correct LVAD patient who's got bloody right stool, or somebody that's going to, you know, is going to go to the ICU within 5 minutes of your evaluation.
History of AFib on Coumadin, right? Or I forgot to take my Coumadin. That's going to be your cues that this is the sick mesenteric ischemia. Now you're calling surgery and taking care of them.
So to take you through some of these things that we talked about, if you've got a lot of the ITE questions are probably going to be what's the next most appropriate management step. And so the next most appropriate management step is do your ABCs or place an IV and treat a hypotensive patient, that's the right answer. But a lot of these will get to the point of don't delay definitive management by delaying your consultation. So if you need to call a surgeon because of something like mesenteric ischemia or because of a brisk lower GI bleed, don't delay that consultation to do putz around with something else until your labs come back or something. But it's always going to be resuscitation first and then early consultation in order to manage these patients. Because if you delay definitive management because you're kind of doing some other stuff, then that's not going to help. And so the foil may be to call GI in a lower GI bleed who's really not going to be able to do stuff, or to start the bowel prep. You know, trust me, somebody with a brisk lower GI bleed is getting some bowel prep. Stuff is moving, okay?
That's another thing. Don't choose start the bowel prep for any of your answers.
And it's not reassurance. This isn't
or H. pylori testing. That's not the answer.
Give them their triple therapy and then wish them well. Have them chew some kale. Yeah. All right, so we wish you all the best of luck on your in-training exam. We hope you enjoyed us talk about poop and bloody poop. And
pre-poop.
Yeah, and pre-poop.
Pre-poop, yeah. That's a good term.
Yeah. That's the most disgusting way to coin food I've ever heard. I hope you've enjoyed this tour from mouth to anus, and we wish you the best of luck on your in-training exam. I think I found a new...
That's so hipster of you.
Farm to table, yeah, mouth to anus. Exactly. I think we found a new name for our podcast.